Even the portable nuclear generators that would power the primitive Soviet and American satellites in the 1960s were insufficient for the needs of the replicated spacecraft. So the question remained, what powered the Roswell spacecraft? I reviewed all of my discoveries in a checklist. The crescent-shaped space vehicle also had no traditional navigational controls as we understood them. There were no control sticks, wheels, throttles, pedals, cables, flaps, or rudders. How did the creatures pilot this ship and how did they control the speed, accelerating from a near-stationary hover above a given spot, like a helicopter, to speeds in excess of 7,000 miles per hour in a matter of seconds? What protected the creatures from the tremendous G forces they would have had to have pulled in any conventional aircraft? Our own pilots in World War II had to wear special devices as they pulled up out of dives that kept the oxygen from flowing out of their brains and causing them to black out. But we found nothing in the flight suits of the creatures that indicated that they faced the same problem. Yet their craft should have pulled 10 times the G forces our own pilots did, so we couldn't figure out how they managed this. No controls, no. 56. Protection, no power supply, no fuel, these were the riddles I listed. Alongside them I listed that the craft itself was an electrical circuit. That the flight suits, flight skins is a better description. The creatures wore were made of a substance whose atomic structure was elongated, strengthened lengthwise, so as to provide a directional flow to any current applied to it. The engineers who first discovered this were amazed at the pure conductivity of these skins, functionally like the skin of the craft itself, and their obvious ability to protect the wearer while at the same time vectoring some kind of electronic field. Where was the physical junction of the circuit between the pilot and the ship? Was it turned on and off somehow by the pilot himself through a switch we didn't know about? Alongside the riddle of the apparent absence of navigational controls, I listed the sensorized headband that so intrigued the officers at Roswell's Walker Field and fascinated me as well. If, as we all suspected, this device picked up the electronic signatures from the creature's oversized brains, what did it do with them? I believed, and our industrial product development from the 1960s through today as the brainwave control helmets finally came into service ultimately confirmed, that these headbands translated the brain's electronic signals into system commands that controlled speed, direction, and elevation. Maybe the headbands had to be calibrated or tuned to each individual pilot, or maybe the pilots, since I believed they were genetically engineered beings biologically manufactured especially for flight or long-term exploration, had to be calibrated to the headband. Either way, the headbands were the interface between the pilot and the ship. But that still didn't resolve the question of the lack of cables, gears, or wires. Maybe the answer lay not in the lack of structural controls but in the way the suit, the headband, the creature's brains, and the entire craft worked together. In other words, when I looked at the possible function of the entire system, the synchronicity between the brain interface in the headband, the pure conductivity of the spacecraft, and the elongated structure of the space skins, which also acted like a circuit, I could see how directional instructions could have been translated by the headbands into some form of current flowing through the skins and into the series of raised deck panels where there were indentations for the creature's hands. The indentations on these panels, as the Roswell Field reports described them, looked like the handprints pressed into the concrete at the old Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Were the directional commands a series of electronic instructions transmitted directly from the creature's brains along their bodies and through the panels into the ship itself as if the ship were only an extension of the creature's body? For that to have been the case, something was still missing. The engine. Again, I settled on the idea of function over structure. The debris and the spacecraft indicated that an engine didn't somehow fall out of the craft when it crashed. A conventional engine was never there in the first place. What we found was that the craft seemed to have had the ability to store as well as conduct a vast amount of current. What if the craft itself were the engine, imparted with a steady current from another source that it stored as if it were a giant capacitor? This would be like charging the battery in an electric car and running it until the battery was drained. Sound far-fetched? It's not much different from filling up a car with gas at the pump and driving until the tank's dry, or fueling a plane and making sure you land before the fuel's gone. I suspected the Roswell craft was simply a capacitor that stored current that was controlled or vectored by the pilot and was able to be recharged in some way or could recharge itself with some form of built-in generator. That would have explained the power supply, I noted alongside the riddle of the missing engine, but what was the means of propulsion and direction? If there was a force that functioned the same way thrust does, it wasn't immediately obvious how it was created and vectored. As early as September 1947, scientists who had gone to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field to see the debris were speculating that the electronic potential of the Roswell craft reminded them of the German and British anti-gravity experiments of the 1920s and 1930s. General Twining was reported to have said more than once that the name of the Serbian electrical engineer and inventor of alternating current, Nikola Tesla, kept bubbling up in the conversation because the scientists examining the damaged craft described the way it must have converted an electromagnetic 57 field into an anti-gravity field. And, of course, the craft itself reminded them of the German experimental fighter aircraft that made their appearance near the end of the war but that had been in development ever since the 1930s. Tesla and a number of other European scientists had been pioneers in the conversion of circumscribed small area anti-gravity fields out of electromagnetic fields. However, the effort to develop true anti-gravity aircraft never came to fruition among conventional aircraft manufacturers because gasoline, jet, and rocket engines provided a perfectly good weapons technology. But the theory of electromagnetic anti-gravity propulsion was not unknown even if it was not well understood and, without a power source like a small portable nuclear fission generator, not at all feasible. But, what if the flying craft already carried enough electric potential and storage capacity to retain its power, just like a very advanced flying battery? Then it might have all the power it needed to propagate and vector a wave directionally by shifting its magnetic poles. If the magnetic field theory experiments carried out by engineers and electrical energy pioneers Paul B. Feld and Townsend Brown in the 1920s at the California Institute for Advanced Studies were accurately reported, and the U.S. military as well as scientific record keepers at the Bureau of Investigation kept very close tabs on what these engineers were doing, then the technological theory for anti-gravity flight existed before World War II. In fact, prototypes for vertical takeoff and landing disc-shaped aircraft had been on the drawing boards at the California Institute since before the war. It was just that in the United States nobody paid them much attention. The Germans did develop and had flown flying discs, or so the intelligence reports read, even though they had no impact on the outcome of the war other than stimulating a race between the United States and the USSR to gather as much of the German technology as possible. Thus, even though engineers had attempted to build vertical takeoff and flying wing aircraft before and had succeeded, the Roswell spacecraft, because it was so truly functional and outflew anything we had, as well as traveled in space, represented a practical technological challenge to the scientists visiting the Air Materiel Command. We knew what the Ebbies did, we just couldn't duplicate how. My reports for Army R&D were analyses of the types of technology that we had to develop to either challenge this spacecraft militarily with a credible defense or build one ourselves. In my notes to General Trudeau, I reviewed for him all the technological implications that I believed were relevant in any discussion about what could be harvested from the Roswell craft. I also wrote up what I understood about the magnetic field technology and how unconventional designers and engineers had drafted prototypes for these anti-gravs earlier in the century. All of this pointed in one direction. I suggested that we now had a craft and could farm out to industry the components that comprised this electromagnetic anti-gravity drive and brainwave-directed navigational controls. We had to dole them out piecemeal once we broke them down into developable units, each of which could have its own engineering track. For that we'd need the advice of the scientists who would eventually comprise our brain trust, individuals we could rely on and whom we could talk to about their Roswell debris. These were scientists who routinely worked with our prime defense contractors and could tell us whom to approach in their R&D divisions for secure and private consultations. I was hoping that the evaluation of the kinds of things we were able to learn from the Ebby and his craft that I was preparing for General Trudeau would lead me toward the solution of some of the physiological problems we knew our astronauts would encounter in space flight. In the early 1960s, astronauts from both the United States and the USSR had made their first orbital flights and had experienced more than a few negative physical symptoms from the weightless environment during the mission. Despite our official claims that humans could travel safely in space, our doctors knew that even short periods of weightlessness were extremely disorienting to some of our astronauts, and the longer the flight, the more uncomfortable the symptoms could become. We were worried about loss of physical strength, reduced muscle capability in the heart and diaphragm, reduction of lung capacity, and loss of tensile strength in the bones. Yet, scattered across the desert floor outside of Roswell were creatures who seemed completely adapted to space flight. Just to be able to examine these entities was an enormous opportunity, but I knew we had the ability to harvest what we could observe about aliens. So, again, alongside the speculations I had made about the Ebbies and their craft, I listed what I thought were the major possibilities of developing products to enable us to travel in space for extended periods of time. Renewable oxygen and food supplies were obvious directions to take, and by the 1960s, NASA engineers were already designing ways to recharge the atmosphere inside a capsule and provide for food storage. We helped. It was Army R&D and our plan for developing an irradiation process for food that even today, 58, provides the basis for non-refrigerated food supplies on board spacecraft. But beyond that were real issues of health and survival. Merely getting human beings into Earth orbit or even launching them into lunar orbit and bringing them back safely were straightforward engineering projects. But the readaptation of the human body to Earth gravity after an extended period of weightlessness or reduced gravity was a far more intractable problem to solve. The physiology of the Ebbies provided an important clue. Besides the development of supertenacity fibers that would protect the astronauts and the skin of the spacecraft and the development of a food preservation process that would neutralize all the bacteria that cause spoilage, we needed to examine the ways we trained our astronauts physically so that they would be more adaptable to periods of weightlessness and spatial disorientation. At the same time, we needed to develop nutritional packages that would not place undue stress on a digestive system that needed to compensate for deprivation of gravity. Since there were no food preparation facilities on board the spacecraft, we didn't know how they stored or processed food or even what they ate, if anything at all. However, my concern over a process to preserve food for space travel was prompted by the obvious challenge posed by the spacecraft itself. If we were going to travel in space, and it was clear from what the Army found at Roswell that at least one culture had developed the technology to do so, then R&D had to find a way to feed our pilots in space. Therefore, we needed to develop a process to preserve food for space missions that didn't require refrigeration facilities and the consumption of excessive amounts of energy. The problem of long-term space travel still hasn't been solved, in part because we continue to rely upon conventional means of propulsion that subject our astronauts to great periods of physical stress, especially during takeoff. We also have no magic way for astronauts to readjust to Earth gravity after a long ride in an orbiting space station like the Russian Mir or our own planned station early in the next century. Manned trips to Mars, also on the drawing boards for early in the 21st century, will also be a problem because they will last for months and subject our astronauts to a great deal of stress. I suggested to General Trudeau in my report that although this wasn't explicitly an Army R&D mission, NASA should begin the preparation of astronaut candidates from the time they're still in school. If we train our astronauts from the time they're children the same way we do with potential athletes at sports camps and provide the most promising candidates with flight training and military or government scholarships to ROTC colleges, we will create a cadre of officers physically adaptable and scholastically trained to enter the next generation of space travel, I wrote. I know that General Trudeau passed this recommendation along because NASA itself opened a space training camp for future astronauts within a few years after my retirement from the service. Beyond the issues concerning the training potential of astronauts for conventionally powered space flight, the examination of the EBI bodies and the ship's possible propulsion system raised other intriguing questions. What if, in addition to having been bioengineered for interstellar travel, the EBIs weren't subjected to the kinds of forces human pilots would routinely face? If the EBIs utilized a wave propagation technology as an anti-gravity drive and navigation system, then they traveled inside some form of adjustable electromagnetic wave. I suggested to General Trudeau that we should study the potential physiological effects on humans of long-term exposure to the kinds of energy spillage generated by the propagation of an electromagnetic field. Biologists needed to determine how feasible such a form of space travel would be based upon whether energy radiation would disrupt the cellular activity of the human body. Perhaps the external one-piece skins worn by the EBIs afforded them protection against the effects of being enclosed in a portable electromagnetic field. Although Army R&D never conducted these studies because the medical issues surrounding space travel were subsumed by NASA under contracts with the military, indirect medical research was conducted years later. Studies surrounding the physiological effects on persons living near high-voltage power transmission lines and persons using extendable antenna handheld cellular telephones both proved inconclusive. While some people argued that there were higher incidences of cancer among both groups, other studies argued just the opposite or found other reasons for any incidences of cancer. I believe that a definitive piece of research on the effects of low energy or ELM wave exposure still needs to be done because, ultimately, even more than atomic energy or ion drives, magnetic field generation will be the system that will propel our near-planetary voyages from 2050 through the early 22nd century. Beyond that, for humans to reach destinations beyond the solar system, technology will require a radically 59. different form of propulsion that will enable them to reach velocities at or beyond the speed of light. Thus did my second report cover the opportunities for research presented to us by the autopsies of the EBIs and from the crash of their vehicle. To my mind, it was nothing less than a confirmation that the research into electromagnetics in the 1920s and the highly experimental saucer and crescent-shaped development of aircraft by the Allies and Axis powers would have led to an entirely new generation of airships. I know that my reports were read by the higher-ups in the military because top-secret research has continued right through to the present on a whole range of designs and propulsion systems from the stealth fighter and bomber to prototypes for a very high-altitude suborbital interceptor aircraft, developed at Nellis and Edwards, now on the drawing board, which can hover in place and fly at speeds over 7,000 miles per hour. Once I finished my report on the opportunities we could possibly derive from the EBIs and the craft, I turned my attention to compiling a short list of immediate opportunities I believed achievable by the Army R&D's Foreign Technology Division from a reverse engineering of items retrieved from the crash. These were specific things, not as theoretical as questions about the physiology of the EBI or the description of its craft. But, while some might call them purely mundane, each of these artifacts, as a direct result of Army R&D's intervention, helped spawn an entire technological industry from which came new products and military weapons. Among the Roswell artifacts and the questions and issues that arose from the Roswell crash, on my preliminary list that needed resolution for development scheduling or simple inquiries to our military scientific community were: image intensifiers, which ultimately became night vision, fiber optics, super tenacity fibers, lasers, molecular alignment metallic alloys, integrated circuits, micro-miniaturization of logic boards, HARP, High Altitude Research Project, Project Horizon, Moon Base, portable atomic generators, ion propulsion drive, irradiated food, third brain guidance systems, EBI headbands, particle beams, Star Wars anti-missile energy weapons, electromagnetic propulsion systems, depleted uranium projectiles for each of the items on my list. General Trudeau went into his human resources file and found the names of scientists working on government defense projects or in allied research projects at universities where I could turn for advice and some consultation. I wasn't surprised to see Wernher von Braun turn up under every rocket propulsion issue. Von Braun had gone on record in 1959 by announcing that the US military had acquired a new technology as a result of top secret research in unidentified flying objects. Nor was I 60 surprised to seconds John von Neumann's name next to the mention of the strange-looking silver-imprinted silicon wafers that I thought looked like elliptical-shaped crackers. If these are what I think they might be, General Trudeau said, printed circuitry, there's only one person we can talk to. Dr. Robert Sarbeker was an especially important contact person on our list of scientists because he had worked on the Research and Development Board during the Eisenhower administration. Not only had Sarbeker been consulted by members of Admiral Hilenko Ettertz and General Vandenberg's working group on UFOs during the 1950s, he was part of the original decision General Twining made to bring all of the Roswell debris back to Wright Field for preliminary examination before farming it out to the military research community. As early as 1950, Sarbeker, commenting on the nature of the debris, said that he was sure the light and tough materials were being analyzed very carefully by government laboratories that had taken possession of the debris after the crash. Because he was already knowledgeable about the Roswell debris, Drive Sarbeker was another obvious candidate for an Army R&D brain trust. We also listed Dr. Wilbert Smith, who, in a memo to the Controller of Telecommunications in November 1950, had urged the Government of Canada to investigate the nature of alien technology the United States had retrieved from crashed extraterrestrial vehicles and that was at that time being studied by Vannevar Bush. Dr. Smith, who had learned of the U.S. investigation from Sarbeker, said that regardless whether UFOs fit into our belief system or not, the fact was we had acquired them and it was important for us to harvest the technology they contained. He implored the government to make a substantial effort to utilize alien technology. General Trudeau joked that although Dr. Smith knew that we had acquired technology at Roswell, he didn't really know what it was. I can't wait to see his face when you open your briefcase in front of him, Phil, the general said, thinking about how his old friend had always wanted to know the specifics of what he had secreted away in 1947. Each of these scientists had maintained existing relationships with any number of defense contractors during the 1950s. General Trudeau also had relationships with the Army contractors who were developing new weapons systems for the military within one part of the company while another part was harvesting some of the same technology for consumer products development. These were companies, Bell Labs, IBM, Monsanto, Dow, General Electric, and Hughes, that General Trudeau wanted to talk to about the list of technological products that we'd compiled from our R&D Roswell nut file. You begin calling our scientist friends, General Trudeau announced. And make whatever appointments you want. Where are you going to be, General? I asked. I'm going to be taking some trips, too, he said. First to the Chief of Staff to make sure we have the discretionary budget we're going to need. Then to some of the people I want you to talk to once you have the backing from the scientific community for the projects on your list. Where to first? I asked. What do you like? The general shot right back to me. We've been working with Image Intensifies for some time, I said. We even got our hands on devices the Germans were working on at the end of the war. Well then, why don't you make a very preliminary trip over to Fort Belvoir, General Trudeau? Said. They've had a night vision project in the works for the past 10 years, but it's got nothing over what you have in your file. 61. I'll get over the first thing, I said. Yes, Phil, but you get out of that uniform and into a real lawyer suit, the general ordered. And don't take your staff car. He saw me raise my eyebrows. All you're going to do is feed a project, Trudeau continued, that's been underway since right after the war. They've got stuff, but you're going to give them a giant leap. Once you've fed them, you'll disappear and I'll assign a night vision project manager here to see the development through. I prepared to leave his office. No one will know, Phil, he said. Just like you thought, the Roswell night viewer will put a seed of an idea in someone's mind over at Fort Belvoir and it will become part of a long project history. It will disappear just like you into the history of the product development. Yes, sir, I said. I was beginning to realize just how lowly this job could be. You still have a suit that fits? The general asked. I think so, I answered. Maybe what I wore over at the White House is a little out of style, but it'll pass. Good luck, Phil, General Trudeau said. Make sure no one knows where you're going and I'll make sure you have all the budget you need. This was the beginning. I saluted, but the general just stuck out his hand and I shook it. We both realized in that moment, as we were striking out on our own, just how momentous this was about to become. A lieutenant general allocating money for his development budget and a lieutenant colonel looking for someone to develop an innocuous, looking eye shield an unknown GI had picked up out of the sand near a UFO crashed into a rock in the lonely desert outside of Roswell in a lightning storm 14 years ago. What a pair we must have made. Chapter 9. The project had officially begun. General Trudeau marched down the hall to his boss at the Pentagon to begin the process of funding the new items we'd identified in our foreign technology budget, and I went home that evening and tried on my official White House three-piece suit. President Eisenhower once told me that he always trusted a man who wore a vest, and I never forgot it. Although there were times when the president asked me to wear my uniform for special meetings when I had to look military, I usually wore suits every day to work. But after my years at the Red Canyon missile base and in combat uniform in Germany, I lost the knack of wearing civilian clothes. Nevertheless, here I was again, after all those years, wearing a suit just like any other 9-2-5 commuting Joe as I headed toward Fort Belvoir, perhaps the Army's most important base in the entire Washington military district. Fort Belvoir was one of those military posts where the mundane activity of training and weapons testing was an effective cover for what came to be known as the secret life of Fort Belvoir. It sat comfortably within 30 minutes of the Pentagon, and it was where some of the Army's most top-secret research into UFO technology was also taking place. Belvoir housed the Army Engineering School and, for former artillery and missile officers like myself, maintained a vital information database about ballistics testing and the development of new weapons. But on the secret side of the ledger, Fort Belvoir was home to the signal school where officers for the National Security Council who had top secret crypto clearance were trained. Even years after I retired from active duty, stories lingered about the records of UFOs that were stored at Fort Belvoir, including photos and even motion pictures of military retrievals of downed extraterrestrial craft. 62. What very few people knew was that an elite secret Air Force unit operated out of Fort Belvoir, ostensibly an Army base, that was responsible for retrievals of downed UFOs. That was how Fort Belvoir became a repository of classified UFO footage. Those secrets remained at Fort Belvoir over the years and were closely guarded while the installation remained shrouded in mystery. For those who suspect what information was kept at the base, Fort Belvoir remains a central part of the legends surrounding the official military cover-up of UFOs.